Let's cultivate our motivation. There's so many different kinds of sentient beings living in so many different kinds of environments all throughout the universe. And all of our minds are completely dominated by self-grasping ignorance and the self-centered thought. So that even though we all want happiness, because we're confused about what creates the cause for happiness, in our struggle for happiness, we actually create causes of suffering. And yet this lifetime we have somehow managed to have a precious human life where we can have a little bit of insight into this process and begin to question our perceptions. Most other beings, they would never even dawn on them that their own minds were the cause of their suffering. They would never begin to question the perceptions that they have or their view of the world. So somehow this lifetime we have this opportunity to do this kind of spiritual questioning and exploration. So incredibly fortunate. So as we do it, as we try and learn about our own minds, how things exist, and so on, then let's do it with a sense of involvement with other living beings. In other words, doing our practice, aiming for full enlightenment, so that we can return the kindness of sentient beings by leading them on the path, helping them to see what are the causes of suffering and what are the causes of happiness. So that instead of wandering in confusion, they too can practice the path. So let's generate that bodhicitta motivation. If you'd like to keep the back door open for ventilation, that's fine with me. And also, I say, there's space up here, and I won't bite. Okay, so today is Vaisak. It's the holiest day in the entire Buddhist year. Sakadawa. Vaisak is the Sanskrit, Sakadawa is the Tibetan. Okay, so it's the holiest day in the entire year because it commemorates, at least according to our tradition, the Buddha's birth, his enlightenment day, and then his passing into nirvana. And so I thought just to begin today with a little bit of discussion about the Buddha's life. Because, personally speaking, I find it very, very inspiring, and I find that his life itself is an example for us. And you might say, well, he lived 2,600 years ago. What does that have to do with me? You know, when he was a prince, and I'm just, you know, whatever I am. Actually, you know, if we look at his life, there's so much in common. That we can really learn. Yeah. So as the story goes, and how much of this is factually true and not, you know, I don't think is very important. I, I majored in history in college, and I concluded that it was gossip from a male's viewpoint. So it doesn't matter what actually happened. It matters what people believe happened. Okay? So the story of Buddha's life, you know, he was born as a prince in the kingdom of Kapilavastu. Okay, so this is 2,600 years ago. So his father and his mother died when he, you know, was an infant, and so his stepmother brought him up. But his parents, like our parents, you know, had their agenda for what their kid was going to grow up to be. Yeah? So he was supposed to grow up and, you know, follow in his father's footsteps and be king of the land and have all the wealth and, you know, do all of this kind of stuff. And so that's how he was trained, you know, as a young person. So he excelled in his studies and, you know, he was the, you know, he was a chief archer, you know. I mean, basically he was the college football star, the high school football star, you know, who was also intelligent, you know. Okay, so he was intelligent, plus he was the high school football star, yeah. And had everything in the world going for him. Of course, married a beautiful woman. You know, I think she was also pretty intelligent, but, you know, they usually leave that out. yeah. And, you know, and had a child. And he, even as he was growing up, he was, you know, kind of, he excelled in everything, but he was also a little bit different. You know, there's a story that when he was, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years old, he was sitting under the rose apple tree and went into samadhi, you know. And then there's another story about his cousin who shot at a swan. His cousin Devadatta, you know, shot the swan and claimed, and the Buddha ran up and rescued the swan and, you know, pulled the arrow out and tended it and so that the animal lived. And Devadatta said, "It's mine." And Buddha said, "No." And so it wound up, you know, going to, I don't know, the elders in the clan, who decided that, of course, because the Buddha, who then was a bodhisattva, had rescued the bird, it actually belonged to him. Okay. So since that time, he and his cousin didn't get along very well. You know, there was kind of like this, they weren't siblings, but almost as, and so a lot of sibling rivalry in there. Okay, so his dad had this, you know, intention for how my son is going to turn out. And so he controlled the Buddha's environment. Yeah. I should actually say the Bodhisattva's environment, because he was a Bodhisattva at that time, as the literal meaning of the story is. And so his father wouldn't let him go out. Yeah, so overprotective parent. Yeah, anybody else have overprotective parent? You know, you can't go out, you can't go anywhere dangerous, you can't go anywhere where you might see something ugly. You know, his father completely worried about his child all the time. So the Buddha did what most of us did. You sneak out. Okay? And so he snuck out of the palace 4 times. He didn't take his dad's car, but he took the chariot. Okay? And the charioteer, you know, drove him out. So the first time when he went out, he saw a sick person. Yeah, because in India, they don't hide what life is about. So there was a sick person. Actually, you know, Capitol Hill, they don't hide it either. Or the U District. So there was a sick person lying on the street. The Buddha had never seen this before. The Bodhisattva hadn't seen it. He said, "What is it?" And his charioteer said, "Oh, it's a sick person." "What does that mean?" "Well, it means that your body doesn't feel well." "Oh, will that happen to me? Can that happen to me?" And the charioteer said, "Yes, happens to all of us." So he went back to the palace, but he was very thoughtful. He didn't get caught, so he snuck out a second time. Yeah. So second time he snuck out, he saw an old person. And again, he hadn't seen old people. I mean, his mother and father, stepmother and father were older, but, you know, as in America, you know, you dye your hair and you do Botox and, you know, the whole thing, so you don't look your age, you look younger. And he didn't know what an old person was. And so the charioteer explained that and explained how we're all in the process of getting older, and we too will one day look like that old person hobbling along on a cane, bent over, walking with pain and difficulty. Okay, so he went back to the palace. Then the third time he went out, there was a body lying in the street. Yeah, a corpse. So it could have been one of the street people who died. It could have been after, you know, some demonstration somewhere where the police got violent. But there was a, could have been a drive-by shooting, you know. I'm just trying to update it, you know. Yeah. Drive-by shooting. So there's a body lying in the street. And he says to his charioteer, "What's that?" And the charioteer explains, "It's a dead person." "What's that?" "Well, you stopped living." "What's that?" "Yeah. Will it happen to me?" "Yes, it happens to all of us." So he really became quite thoughtful when he went back to the palace. You know, because here he is, living in the middle of all this luxury, and yet seeing sickness, aging, and death. He snuck out a fourth time. And the fourth time, he saw in the marketplace or in the countryside a wandering mendicant, because India was full of wandering mendicants at that time. So it was a person wearing rags, shaved head, very few possessions. And again, he had never seen that because he had always lived in the lap of luxury. And so this charioteer had to explain to him, "Well, that's a wandering mendicant." "Well, what's that?" You know, it's someone who's trying to find their way out of this cycle of constantly recurring rebirth. Somebody who's trying to overcome sickness, aging, and death. So he went back to the palace. His wife had just had a baby, so they were having this gala celebration. Of course, his wife was home with the child, and he was there with all the maidens, all the dancing maidens, having a great time, you know. But this was still kind of going on in the back of his mind. And then at the end of the evening, the party was over, all of these beautiful dancing girls fell asleep on the floor, and like all of us when we sleep, we're like all over, you know, snoring, you know, and moving around in our sleep. And so suddenly these dancing girls didn't look so gorgeous. And he thought, you know, I really have to learn more about what life is about and what this wandering mendicant is trying to do. And so he decided to leave the palace. He basically ran away from home. Okay, but he didn't run away from home because he hated his parents, and he didn't run away from home because he wanted to retaliate for, because people had been awful to him, and he didn't run away from home to indulge in drugs. You know, he you know, left because he really had this very strong spiritual yearning, and it was important. So he left in all of his finery. And the men at that time had long hair. They wore jewelry, you know, so they had their earlobes were stretched out by the very heavy, you know, jewelry they were wearing. So after he left, you know, he took off his royal silks and brocades and traded them for rags. He cut off his hair, and he became a wandering mendicant. He sent the charioteer back to the palace and said, "Tell him to forget about me." Well, you can only imagine, you know, his father probably freaked out and sent everybody in the kingdom out to look for him, you know. But you know, he eluded them, and he went to study with the wise people of his times. So there were two great spiritual practitioners that he went to study with. And one of them was a master of meditation who taught the Buddha meditation. He attained these very deep states of samadhi. And such a deep state of samadhi that he became the equivalent of his teacher. So his teacher, you know, said, come and lead the rest of the group with me. And the Bodhisattva said no, because he realized that he hadn't attained full enlightenment. Okay? So this was a sign of integrity. Yeah? Most of us, yeah, the spiritual master thinks that we're equal to them and wants us to lead the group. Wow, we're right there. Yes, yes, sirree, I have all these qualities, and here is my dana basket, and put your offerings right there. Okay? And just have enough faith in me, and I will lead you to unsurpassed enlightenment for $99.99 plus tax and interest, and don't you dare go to another teacher, and I'm it. Okay? I mean, that's what it's like, isn't it? You know? If anybody who can become a spiritual teacher, and here I am, and I'll do it, and just have faith. Don't ask too many questions. But, the Bodhisattva didn't say that. He knew it for himself. He knew his own level of realization, and then he hadn't yet attained full enlightenment. He wasn't yet free of suffering. So he said no. Yeah. And he left that teacher, not out of anger or anything, but to learn more, you know, to build on what he had learned from that teacher. So he met another teacher, you know, who had reached an even deeper state of concentration. And he practiced that. He became, as good as that teacher. And that teacher was older and said, I want to retire here. You can have the whole Dharma Center, you know. And again, he realized that he wasn't fully enlightened, and he wasn't looking for prestige and honor, and he said no. And so again, he declined, and he went off. And this time he met five ascetics, because there was really a tradition in ancient India, a little bit kind of like the Catholic Church before the Vatican II, this idea that, you know, the body is evil and sinful, and if you torture your body, somehow you'll control your lust and your desire. Okay? So, you know, it didn't beat themselves with the... What did they used to use in the church?
What? Self-flagellation?
Yeah, self-flagellation. They didn't do that. But it was the same kind of thing if you had to be very ascetic in order to conquer your body. So he didn't eat. Yeah, or I should say he ate one grain of rice a day. And he got so thin that when he touched his belly button, he could feel his spine. And again, he meditated in very deep states of samadhi with his five friends. And he did this for 6 years. 6 years, this extremely ascetic practice. I mean, we have a hard time going without food for one day. Yeah, or eating one grain of rice for one day. You know, he did that for 6 years. And he realized that torturing your body and being extremely ascetic did not calm the mind. It made the body weak. It made you spaced out. But it didn't take away the attachment or the lust or the anger or anything like that. So he decided to give that practice up. And he, you know, said goodbye to his friends, and he was going to go off and meditate alone. And of course his five friends said, oh, look at him, he's such a slackard, he wants to go eat, he has no courage or perseverance. Okay, so they weren't too happy, but, you know, the Bodhisattva wasn't concerned with what other people thought of him, whether they approved or didn't approve or liked him or didn't like him. He just knew that he was going for enlightenment and hadn't attained it yet. So he received, one young woman came and offered some food to him, and that nourished his body and gave him his strength back. And he crossed this river, and went into what is now modern day Bodh Gaya and sat under a Bodhi tree and vowed not to get up until he had attained full enlightenment. So he sat down in the evening, so that would be last night as the anniversary goes. Okay? And then he meditated throughout the night. So just like us, he faced various hindrances in his meditation. So one hindrance was anger. So as the story goes, Mara, who is not the devil, but more like a trickster who was, doesn't wish people harm, but doesn't want them to get enlightened, so causes interferences. So Mara came and sent out all of his kids as warriors who were attacking the Buddha as he was trying to meditate. And the Buddha transformed them. He made a shower of flowers fall. He changed their weapons into flowers, and then the flowers fell, okay? And so without their weapons, then all these, angry people left. So that's kind of like in our meditation. Sometimes you sit down to meditate, and your mind is roiling with anger, you're sitting in a completely silent room with nobody who's bothering you, and, your mind is just furious. Ever had that happen? Yeah? So, that's a symbolic way of describing that state of mind. So, but he meditated on patience to transform the weapons into flowers, so the whole thing got resolved. Okay. Then, like us, he had difficulties with attachment and excitement and the wine world, going all over the place. So as the story goes, Mara sent all of his gorgeous daughters to try and entice the Buddha. Yeah, I'm sending them all, and they're doing all their thing. And he just kept meditating, and he transformed them all into old hags. And so they left. Okay, so that's like our meditation. You sit down to meditate, and then what's running through your mind? Food and sex and we're holiday places and all your objects of attachment. Okay, so what do? You change them into their ugly aspect, and you see that there's no lasting happiness from them, and then the situation resolves. Okay, so he, faced similar things as we do. And then he developed, he went into his the jhanic states, the states of single point of concentration in the form realm. And as he did that, he was able to recall all of his previous lives. Okay. Now, we might think, oh, wow, I want to know all my previous lives. I bet I was Cleopatra. I bet I was Abraham Lincoln. I was probably this really famous, wise, fantastic person in history. Have you ever noticed that all these people who remember their past lives, they're almost always somebody who's very famous? Nobody ever remembers being Cleopatra's servant who she executed, or being, Napoleon's footman who he decapitated. Nobody remembers that. They all remember being somebody famous. Anyway, he saw all of his previous lives. Now, in samsara, they say we've been everything and done everything. Okay? So we've been born in the lowest realms of existence due to having murdered other living beings or stolen their things or caused them trauma or abused them. Okay, we've been born in horrible rebirths as a result of our negative karma. We've been born in the super duper sense deluxe pleasure of Beverly Hills, or I've never learned in Seattle what I'm supposed to say for the comfort. What?
Madison Park.
Madison Park? Okay. Anywhere, the real ritzy part of town, okay? So we've had, been born in those realms where you have more sense of pleasure than that. We've been born as these gods who have single point of concentration, who just stay in their samadhi, no hassles, having to go to work or anything like that, okay? So, as they say, been there, done there, that, got the t-shirt, you know, for everything in samsara. Now, can you imagine what would it be like remembering your all these previous lives? Do you think your mind can endure it? Do you think your mind could endure having a memory of having harmed somebody tremendously, or been cruel, or killed somebody? Yeah. Do you think your mind could stand some of the remembering that we too have done some of the, you know, horrendous things that we see happening on this planet, that we were actually the perpetrators of them at some time or another, due to our confused mind? I think it must have taken incredible strength of mind to be able to remember all of his previous rebirths. And so when you remember all your previous rebirths, what kind of conclusion are you going to draw from that? Where's your mind going to go when you've remembered everything you've been in samsara? If you have a healthy mind, where's your mind going to go? I want out, right? You know, samsara, enough is enough. You know, I've been up and down and around in samsara, and I've been there and I've done that, and I can't stand it anymore, you know. And if my ignorance, anger, and attachment are keeping me bound in this state of cyclic existence, going around and around and around, then I've got to destroy them, because I want out of this situation, because I don't want to ever harm other living beings like that again, and I don't want to ever be harmed by them again, and I don't want to be born in a lower rebirth because of my negative actions, and I don't want to be born in an upper rebirth because of my positive actions, because none of it brings lasting happiness. Okay? So you can see in his meditation, through his own experience of seeing all these rebirths, what intense, you know, renunciation and determination that he gained. Yeah, really intense and clear, you know, not being distracted by somebody coming back and saying, well, if you come back to the kingdom, we'll give you a pay raise and rebuild your palace and, you know. No, he wasn't interested in any of that. It was like, enough. Okay. Then that was the first watch of the night. Then the second watch of the night, second part of the night, through his samadhi, he saw all sentient beings, how they pass away and how they get reborn due to their karma. Okay. So he was able to look around and see all of us, whoever we were 2,600 years ago, how we left that body, how we were going to be born in another body. Everybody, yeah, in the past, how they died, how they're going to get reborn due to their karma. Now, imagine having that appear vividly to your mind, how everybody else is going to die and be reborn according to their karma. What's that going to do to your mind? You know? You're going to see some people dying horrible rebirths, being angry and having negative karma ripen in an awful rebirth. You're going to see people, you know, maybe take refuge when they're dying and have some good karma ripen and have a good rebirth. You're going to see people in the human realms be born in lower realms, be born in upper realms, beings in lower realms, being born in other places, everybody transmigrating, separating from everybody they love, separating from their bodies, separating from their possessions, separating from everything that they spent their whole life building up, dying, getting reborn in another place again and again and again. Okay. If you saw that with deep, direct perception, what effect is that going to have on your mind? You want to help them get out. Okay, so great compassion. great compassion.
Yeah.
I'm unable to bear the suffering of others. Not the freaked out, unable way to bear the suffering of others like we feel, because we don't like the discomfort of seeing others suffer, but really feeling from their side the intensity of their suffering and saying, I can't just sit by and let this continue to go on. I have to do something. So this is very intense compassion and bodhicitta that led to the aspiration for full enlightenment. So he continued to meditate. And then, right at dawn, yeah, he realized, you know, the ultimate nature of reality, cleansed his mind of all the contaminations, all the afflictions, all the latencies and stains on the mind. And he had knowledge that his mind was fully liberated. Yeah. The knowledge of liberation. Liberation by mind, liberation by wisdom, they call it. And he knew now all the afflictions have been ceased. All the latencies have been cleansed. Yeah. Everything that needed to be done has been done. And samsara is finished. Not only my own samsara, but he thought, now I have the ability to be of the greatest benefit to others. Okay? And so that happened at dawn of this morning. Okay? And then, right after he gained that realization, he stayed around Bodh Gaya for 7 weeks. And he was thinking, who is ever going to understand what I just realized? Yeah? Who is ever going to understand? If I try and explain to worldly people that their attachment makes them suffer, they're going to tell me I'm nuts. You know, if I try to explain to worldly people that anger creates war and suffering and misery, and they need to cultivate patience and tolerance, they're going to lock me up as being a communist. You know? It's like, you know, who am I ever going to talk to who will understand what I'm trying to say? So as the story goes, the great gods, the great Hindu gods, came and requested the Buddha to teach the Dharma. So in a Western paradigm, this would be like Jesus and Muhammad and Moses all coming and asking the Buddha to teach the Dharma, saying that there are some beings with just a little dust in their wisdom eye, and they'll understand. Yeah. And so then the Buddha thought, I'll help my two previous teachers. Yeah, because they were kind to me. But then he saw with his clairvoyance that both of them had just died in the last week. Can you imagine being so close to having the Buddha come and teach you, and yet you didn't have that karma? And then he thought of his five friends, you know, all the ones who were jeering at him, saying he was a softy because he started eating again. And he thought, I'll go help them. So he saw that they were in Sarnath, which was, it's a good walk from Bodh Gaya. But he set out on the road and he walked. And when it took him some weeks to get there, but when his friends saw him coming, they said to each other, oh, there's that Gotama, that softy. You know, when he comes, don't make a seat for him. We'll say hello, but, you know, we really don't want to have much to do with him. But as the Buddha approached, just his presence, who he was as a living being, spoke so loudly and clearly that they found themselves preparing a seat for him, offering him water, and so on. And then they began to converse with him and asked him what he had learned. And he started to teach them the Four Noble Truths. Yeah? And so that was the first teaching. Yeah? That samsara by nature is unsatisfactory. That the origin of samsara, cyclic existence, is ignorance, and it's perpetuated by craving and the other afflictions. that there exists the cessation of all of this unsatisfactoriness and its origins, and that there's an actual path to practice to get there. And he taught them. And so slowly, one by one, they all realized the truth of what he said and gained the various stages on the path. Okay? And became arhats. And then he, wandered around ancient India teaching. Many people sought refuge in him. Many people sought monastic ordination. And so we had then the formation of the Sangha. And if you read the Pali Canon, you really get this feeling of the Buddha as a human being, as an individual. And he was quite extraordinary, because he would talk to anybody, absolutely anybody. In India, in those days, so many people had so many different beliefs, and many different groups, and they all held on to their beliefs very strongly. Okay, so it was like he was living in the middle of, a country where everybody was born again, but born again into something different. But that same fervent, this is the way it is. But he would talk with everybody, and so the Brahmins, who were the rich ones, who did all these rituals because they were the high caste, he talked with the poor people. He talked with everybody at their own level and gave them the teaching that they needed. It's quite incredible. Yeah? And so he wandered around living a very simple lifestyle. So although he became very renowned, he never got a luxury vehicle. Okay? He didn't wear silk and brocade. He lived as a wandering mendicant. Yeah? Eating before noon, not handling money, having, one set of robes and something to change into once in a while, going on alms round, not working for a living, making himself completely dependent on others' kindness and generosity to stay alive. And he did this, for 45 years, teaching everyone and anyone. Quite remarkable. Yeah. He never said, that person smells bad, I don't want to be near them, or that person's lower caste, I can't be seen in their presence, or nothing like that, okay? And then, of course, as everybody does, he passed away when he was 80. So they say his first teaching was about impermanence, and so was his last teaching. Yeah, okay, so the first teaching about the Four Noble Truths, talking about impermanence when he talked about the First Noble Truth, and then by his own life example, passing away, showing that all of us must die. Yeah. But the thing was, the Buddha made the awareness of death something that made his life very vibrant and meaningful. Okay? And so instead of having this freaked out fear of death, he recognized, yes, I'm going to die. As soon as you're born, death is the alternative. It's happening. Yeah, it's reality. And so he used that awareness to think, then how can I make my own life meaningful? Yeah. When I die, what will I be glad that I've done? What will I have remorse that I've done? And so holding that awareness now of how he might feel when he died, he really lived his life now according to his own values. And so he didn't harm others, and he didn't pollute the environment, yeah, or take more than his fair share of resources or whatever, but really led an impeccably ethical life, so that when he died there could be no regret. And then, of course, he developed the determination to be free, the bodhicitta, the wisdom. And, when he thought about death, like I said, instead of getting panicky and freaked out about it, he thought, what do I need to do now so that I can die peacefully? Mm-hmm. And the answer came, practice the Dharma. So what does that mean? Lead a good ethical life, cultivate love and compassion, generate bodhicitta, understand emptiness. Because if we do that, then when the time comes to die, death is not, won't be anything to be afraid of. Death will be, you know, just one other thing that happens. Because you realize that there's no solid, concrete me here that's going to die. There never was any solid, concrete me here. Yeah. So if there never was, certainly that thing can't die. And he realized, I'm not my body. My body is this, you know, recycled tofu. Yeah, and carrots and broccoli. There's nothing here to hang on to in this thing. Yeah? And so when you left the body, you just leave the body. Goodbye. Yeah? Without, oh, my body, I can't leave it. You know, the sack of pus, blood, and poop, you know? I can't leave it, I've got to hang on to it. No, he didn't think that way, you know? He thought a body is useful for practicing Dharma, but when it ages, let it go, it's okay, no problem. Yeah? And so being able to be relaxed when all of that happens, and then turn his mind, you know, to meditating on love and compassion. If you meditate on love and compassion, there's no way your mind's going to be miserable. Whether you're living or sick or dying or winning the lottery, if you're meditating on love and compassion, your mind's going to be peaceful and happy. Okay? So that's just a little bit about the Buddha's life. And I personally, you know, I feel there's so much to contemplate in the Buddha's example of how he lived. Okay? I mean, the Buddha lived a simple lifestyle. He was a monastic. He wasn't a classy consumer. That's saying something to us. Yeah? Okay. So I find it very inspiring. The place in where I took ordination in Kaohsiung, Taiwan, it was a huge temple. And around the outside of the temple, they had carvings of these major events of the Buddhist life, you know, like his birth and shooting the swan being shot down and the asceticism and the enlightenment and all these different things. And I used to like to circumambulate and look at each one of the pictures and think about what the Buddha was doing and relate that to my life. Yeah. Because, you know, the Buddha faced the same social pressure that we did. He probably even faced more because he was the king, or supposed to be the king. Yeah? So he faced social pressure, he faced his parents, he faced the whole lure of samsara, you know? But he just did it because that's, in his heart, what he knew was important. And so I found it so helpful for my mind, just going and contemplating these different things. Yeah. There was one story. I mean, if you, and like I said, if you really read about the Buddha's life, you get a lot of inspiration. You know, his cousin Devadatta that I was telling you about. So his cousin, you know, was perpetually jealous and competitive and wanted to take over the leadership of the Sangha. Because he said, you know, oh, Buddha's leader, I want to be leader. Okay? So he, you know, set up some new rules and split the Sangha and, you know, caused incredible amount of disharmony. And he also tried to kill the Buddha several times. Yeah, so if you have problems with your relatives, you know, the Buddha did too, you know. I mean, his cousin was trying to kill him. Can you imagine that? Yeah. And so one of the ways his cousin tried to kill him was by releasing a mad elephant. Okay? So that's kind of like sending out an assassin, you know, a paid assassin to get somebody. So his cousin sent out this crazed elephant who's just like, you know, charging towards the Buddha. Of course, all of the Buddha's disciples are freaking out, you know, because they're afraid he's going to get hurt or killed. And the Buddha just sat there and he meditated on love. Yeah? And he meditated on love for all sentient beings, but especially this crazed elephant who was about to kill him. And he just thought, you know, here's a sentient being who, like me, wants to be happy and doesn't want to suffer. Here's a sentient being who's been kind to me in the past, will be kind to me in the future. Yeah, this situation is caused by my karma. There's no sense getting angry at everybody else. You know, I have the opportunity to, you know, to die in a peaceful way, even though it's going to be kind of a violent death. But I'm okay with that, and I don't have any animosity or resentment for my cousin or for this elephant. Yeah? Can you imagine? And so he meditated on love. And what happened is the power of his meditation was so strong that even the crazed elephant felt it. And by the time he got to the Buddha, he bowed down and offered respect. Isn't that a beautiful story? Yeah, I love that story. Because what that tells me, you know, is if I hang in there and generate love and compassion for somebody who's trying to harm me, my mind will be peaceful, and eventually that other person will come around. So there's many stories like this that, you know, are really examples for how we can live. So today, you know, is marking that day of the Buddha's birth, his enlightenment, his passing away. It's a nice day to remember his life and to take his life as an example. You know? And don't just think that, oh, well, he was born enlightened, and so, you know, in order to get anywhere, you have to be born enlightened, and, you know, who am I? You know, I'm just little old me, what can I do? You know, don't think like that. But really think, look at, you know, what he had to go through to attain his realizations. And look at how many sentient beings have benefited since he did. I mean, how many people have benefited from the teachings the Buddha taught in the last 2,600 years because he put in that effort? So if we think about that, then it really, it gives us a lot of inspiration and encouragement to practice ourselves and to know that we aren't alone, and that everything we're going through in our struggle to practice Dharma, you know, that others have gone through similar situations in their lives and they've come out the other side of it. You know, if you hang in there and you practice, these things get resolved and you come out from them. If you throw up your arms midway, you know, if the Buddha said, oh, my cousin's trying to kill me, forget all of this, you know, goodbye, I'm tired of teaching, all these people expect me to walk here and to walk there, they never say thank you, some of them forget to feed me, then they fight with each other, I'm fed up, you know, I'm out of here, I want to go back to Beverly Hills and just enjoy my, you know, my kingdom. Yeah, he didn't do that. Yeah. And so as a result, you know, how many millions and zillions of sentient beings have benefited? And to think, you know, that our life can become like that too and have that kind of influence and you know, make it meaningful for other living beings.